You're listening to This Week in Fantasy Baseball. Hello, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Fantasy Baseball. I'm John Cudd, joined by my co-host Patrick Fitzgerald. We have reached a new year. It is 2026, so happy new year. Patrick, how are you doing?
Hey, John, I'm doing okay. Happy to be stepping into a new year, fantasy baseball season, getting a little closer, which I'm excited about after the Ravens, you know, broke our hearts a little early this year, and now we fired our coach. So big football changes coming, but that can wait till next year. I'm getting excited for baseball, and I'm honestly thinking about drafting sometime before the month is over. So we'll see if I get around to it. But yeah, I'm looking forward to the season.
Wow, I did not see John Harbaugh getting axed as something that could have happened, but it feels like he's just been there for the longest time. But similar, Vikings were out of the contention pretty quickly through the season, so not a lot to root for in terms of football. Basketball's been going pretty well, hockey's been going pretty well, but baseball season is picking up already. I know we've got PitchCon coming up at the end of this month, so that's happening, and then WBC feels like it's just around the corner as well. I know, you know, players have been announcing what teams they're playing for. It feels like most of the free agents have signed. I know there's still a couple really big ones that are still out there. But yeah, just in like what, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, pitchers and catchers report, and we're going to be back into this craziness again.
Yeah, really, really would be nice to see some of those big names get ticked off just so more dominoes start to fall into place. But I guess it's not a big deal as long as, you know, big names don't start leaking into like mid spring training, like sometimes happens. That would be, you know, just kind of a headache for fantasy planning and just for the teams too.
For sure. Yeah. Imagine trying to figure out where to draft Kyle Tucker because you have no idea where he's going to be ending up. So, yeah, definitely some weird things to figure out. But we are going to talk today about 2025. And just looking at some underperforming and overperforming pitchers from last year, just looking at, what was kind of going on there? Is this an indicator of anything special? And how can we interpret that to apply to 2026? But before we get into all that, just a reminder, you can follow our podcast on Twitter at ThisWeekPL. You can send us your fantasy baseball questions to our email at thisweekplpod@gmail.com. Lastly, make sure you subscribe to or follow the podcast on whatever streaming platform you listen to. We're on all of them, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube. Wherever you listen, make sure you follow us and leave a 5-star review if you enjoy the show. All right, so we're going to talk about overperforming and underperforming pitchers, and kind of similar to what we talked about with hitters a couple weeks ago, you know, we're looking at some specific metrics to define what's overperforming, what's underperforming. So, yeah, Patrick, kind of give us the rundown here of what we're going to be looking at.
Yeah, so to build on our talk on underperforming and overperforming hitters a little while back this offseason, we're going to jump into pitchers today. I used XFIP for our ERA estimator. Just because a couple of reasons. One, it's more predictive than ERA. So if you think about predictive means, if you compare someone's XFIP from the past season and use that as the projection for their ERA the next season, it's going to be more accurate actually than ERA. So it's, you know, it's a good metric to look at, like most ERA estimators are. And also XFIP's relatively straightforward. FIP, you know, XFIP's a derivative of FIP. FIP calculates an ERA estimator just based on home runs, strikeouts, and walks. XFIP, the only thing that it adds in is it accounts for the type of batted ball in terms of it applies a league average home run to fly ball rate for a pitcher. So if someone gives up a ton of home runs per fly ball, they're going to look a little bit better in XFIP than FIP. So it does, you know, help out guys who maybe get some more ground balls, you know, compared to somebody with the same strikeout and walk rates. And then just in terms of what it doesn't account for, just like XWOBA doesn't account for everything. Neither does XFIP. It doesn't account for park, generally, defense, batted ball quality, aside from, you know, home run or ground ball, fly ball, line drive, and then, you know, variation in situational pitching, which no ERA estimator accounts for, right? Like, a lot of pitchers are more willing to give up a home run when there's nobody on base because it only gives you one run, but they might go more for strikeouts with runners on. That type of thing is not necessarily going to be captured by XFIP. But nevertheless, it's really, you know, it's important to kind of identify these buy low guys or sell high guys, you know, in terms of if they underperformed or overperformed.
Yeah, and I think one of the most interesting things that I realized while doing some research for this podcast was how impactful using that average home run rate is to the ERA estimator and how it kind of defines who's underperformer, overperformer. And I was kind of expecting, you know, some names. We'll talk through some of these names. Like, you know, I definitely expected more Reds pitchers, for example, to be in the underperformers, you know, just kind of assuming that, oh, they have a high home run to fly ball rate. But that's not necessarily the case all the time. You know, expecting guys from Seattle to be the guys who are overperformers, right, because they have such a low home run to fly ball rate. But that's also not the case. So even though it doesn't always sort of match up with what you expect in terms of who the pitchers might be that are underperforming or overperforming these metrics, it is kind of interesting to see how when you standardize home run rate, how drastically that can kind of affect the way that you look at these pitchers, whether they are, you know, good performers or poor performers from the previous year.
Right. And I think that home run per fly ball rate is an important stat to normalize sometimes, just to look at it, because it does vary a ton from season to season for hitters and for pitchers, probably more for hitters. But for pitchers, you know, it's not necessarily the type of thing that you see consistently be above average for you know, the same guy year in and year out. So it's important to, you know, take a look at, maybe they give up a couple wall scrapers and, you know, just normalize it and kind of take them, you know, take a step back. But yeah, let's jump into it. So the top 10, we're going to start with the underperformers. So these guys had the biggest difference between their XFIP and their ERA in terms of on the bad side, right? So their XFIP was significantly lower than their ERA. And again, tried to keep it to fantasy relevant guys. The top end here is 1.23 runs of difference, and the low end is 0.53. So it was Brandon Pfaadt, Sonny Gray, Sandy Alcantara, Dylan Cease, Shane Boz, George Kirby, Jack Flaherty, Zach Gallen, Jesus Luzardo, and Will Warren. So a lot of guys, you know, who probably you're expecting to be good for your teams last year, and some of them were decent, and then some of them were completely unplayable, and, you know, maybe underperformance played a role in that. So we are going to jump in with new Boston Red Sox, Sonny Gray. He had a 4.28 ERA versus an elite 3.07 XFIP. This is Sonny Gray's second straight year of underperforming his XFIP by more than a run. But if you look at it in terms of his career, it's actually almost identical at 3.58 ERA and 3.54 XFIP. So, you know, maybe this is some bad luck here. But at the same time, Fenway is a tough place to pitch, right? And Sonny Gray is going to be throwing half his starts there now. So do you think that he could continue to be an underperformer, or do you see him as like a, you know, a really nice buy low kind of right outside the top 100?
Yeah, I think looking back to even when Sonny Gray was a Twin, he had some crazy home run per fly ball rates, like super low rates, right? Then he went to Cardinals and that rate goes back up to, you know, kind of what you expect of, you know, league average. I think some weird things I noticed when looking at Gray's season last year, his BABIP on ground balls went up a lot. It went from 210 to 261. And part of that was, I guess, the St. Louis defense behind him got worse last year. They went from 29 defensive runs saved in 2024 to 5 in 2025. So a very sharp decline there. And yet I think the general consensus has been that St. Louis defense is pretty solid, and now he's going to a Boston defense that's in a little bit more flux than maybe that Cardinals defense, which could be interesting if, you know, this ground ball issue continues to be a thing for Gray, and if that, you know, batting average on goes ground balls goes up, which is going to, you know, necessarily lead to more runs and stuff like that. He did give up a little bit more hard contact in 2025, nothing like crazy. A part of me just thinks that the past 2 years have been kind of more consistent in what we're expecting to see out of Sonny. And I don't think necessarily that there's going to be any remarkable improvement for him going to Boston, but I also don't think there's going to be like a super high regression as well. I think the pitcher that he was the past 2 years in St. Louis is probably going to be the pitcher he's going to be in Boston. And I think that makes him, you know, a pretty good buy low target, just because I wouldn't expect it to get any worse for him in moving to the AL East.
Yeah, you think maybe the divisional games will be a little tougher, but obviously they don't play as many as they used to. I think that there's going to be some regression back here. But at the same time, you know, while he's not a career underperformer, he's kind of changed the way he pitches a little bit the last couple of years. You know, he's living in the zone more. His stuff is a little bit diminished. So when you combine those two things, he's probably going to allow more hard contact, right? So he might be the type of guy who gives up more home runs than you would expect based on his fly ball rate, just because he is living in the zone a little bit more with a, you know, below average fastball velocity. But at the same time, he gets a lot of strikeouts. He seems to be a decent bet for WHIP, even though there is a little bit of an ERA risk. So especially in Fenway. So yeah, I think that I'm not crossing him off my board. I think I'm probably comfortable with the price right now, but not necessarily maybe jumping at it.
Yeah, one thing to add to that point you made about his difference in style and pitching too, kind of the pitches that saw pretty sharp declines in swing and strike rate last year, his sinker, his cutter, and his changeup all went down. That being said, his CSW actually stayed around the same. So he is living in the zone a little bit more. He isn't like trying to get whiffs as much. And because he has that kind of kitchen sink sort of, you know, approach where he just has a bunch of different pitches, even though, you know, three of his pitches basically become not as effective in getting whiffs, all his other pitchers still are able to kind of pick up the slack a little bit and pick up a couple more strikes here and there.
Yeah, definitely one of those guys who's going to lean on, you know, 5 to 6 pitches, especially as he, you know, continues to age and the velocity might continue to be diminished.
Yeah.
So from one guy, the second biggest underperformer was someone who really hurt your teams. Obviously, there's a lot of excitement about Sandy Alcantara coming off of Tommy John surgery, but he just didn't deliver, at least not until the last couple months of the year. He had a 5.36 ERA, one of the worst in the league for qualified pitchers, and a 4.19 xFIP, which is, you know, okay, but probably not super useful for our more shallow leagues. One thing that you can definitely look at here and blame some of the struggles on is a career low left on base rate at 62%. But he also had a career low swinging strike rate. I think it was just under 10%, maybe at 10%, depending where you look. But yeah, so there was some bad luck here, but there was also some skills regression. And I also kind of noticed in looking through Sandy's career, he struggles a lot with left on base rate. His career left on base rate is like 69-70% compared to 72 or 73 for the league average. But he just struggles pitching with runners on base. He has a 26-point wOBA split when there's a 26-point lower wOBA with bases empty versus runners on base, and the league average there is like 13. So he's got, you know, double the size of the gap. So I'm not sure I feel comfortable, you know, just kind of projecting him to get his left on base rate back up. And then, you know, the ERA will be in the high threes and he'll eat a ton of innings. He's going like 150, 155 right now. So not a huge price, but are you concerned about the ratios here? Or are you more optimistic in him turning it around?
Yeah. Part of me wants to say like, hey, it was just returning from injury. And so, yeah, it wasn't that great to the start of a season. I guess the weird stuff, though, is that, you know, he really relied on that changeup as his second most used pitch, but it wasn't that great for him. But granted, like, his third and fourth pitch, his four-seamer was just no longer a whiff pitch for him. That was generating a lot of whiffs in previous seasons. His slider more or less became non-existent. It went from, I think, like a 20% usage to a 3% usage, partially because it was just awful. So he just shelved it and decided to, you know, rely on his other pitches. I think the place where I would have optimism for is just the fact that if you look at his month-by-month splits, they're a lot better. So in March and April, 26 innings, he had an 8.31 ERA. But he finishes September-October with 26 innings, 3.71 ERA, right? So there's some market improvement for him. I think that's just kind of coming back, getting in the swing of things, pitching again at a major league level after being out for almost two seasons with Tommy John, essentially. And so I feel optimistic about Sandy in 2026. I think that optimism is a little muted just with the fact that, like, hey, the pitches still didn't look great. But overall, like, I think he finished out the season relatively strong and kind of in line with that xFIP that that we had there at a 4.19. I think if you look at his September split specifically, he had a 3.53 xFIP. And then, again, he finished with that 3.71 ERA. So it's not as much of a divide on a month basis as opposed to a season basis. Obviously, smaller sample size, yada, yada, yada. But I do think that, you know, going at 150 to me seems pretty reasonable for Sandy. If you want to reach for him a little bit, I don't think there's anything wrong with that either.
Yeah, I'm honestly not sure which way to go on this one. I'm just thinking about, I think Pablo Lopez is going maybe like 10 picks before that, and I would probably take him every single day of the week. For me, it's just trying to figure out what you're drafting Sandy for, right? Obviously, the volume is likely to be top 10 in the league, even coming off of elbow surgery a couple of years ago. But you know, the volume is not going to give you a lot of strikeouts, even less than, you know, someone like Logan Webb. So I guess you're hoping he, you know, spikes a decent ERA season and the whip is okay. I do think the Marlins, like, I think it's overblown that they're a terrible team. I think that they're just kind of slightly below average. So, you know, hopefully he can work deep and get some wins. But, yeah, I'm just not sure. Maybe a better 15-team pick where, like, you just need kind of volume rather than a 12-teamer. I feel like maybe I'd want someone with a little bit more, at least ratio upside at that point.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good point. I do think he has a lot more value in quality starts leagues, for sure.
Definitely.
But, yeah, that strikeout issue is interesting because that's just been a consistent thing with him his entire career, and it's partially because of how deep he goes into games. His caper nines always just don't look great. But, yeah, you probably want to bolster your roster with a couple, you know, strike throwers that you can get in your early rounds before – you know, trying to rely on a guy like Sandy.
Yeah. So jumping to the next guy, who was definitely one of the most frustrating pitchers to roster this year. I had him in at least one league, so I was right there with you guys. Dylan Cease, New Toronto Blue Jay, 4.55 ERA versus 3.56 xFIP. Cease is interesting. You know, he's a guy who you don't see a lot of highly drafted pitchers like him. You don't expect the ratios to be really more than slightly above average, even though he spikes ones every once in a while. You draft him for the strikeouts and hopefully the wins, especially on this, you know, loaded Blue Jays team. But yeah, it was a struggle last year. He's really hurt you pretty much everywhere except strikeouts. And he is a little bit of a career FIP underperformer with a 0.2 difference between his ERA and his FIP. But xFIP, it's not really the case. There's only, you know, 4 to 4 hundredths of a run difference there. So it's not like Cease is a guy who just gives up a ton of home runs per fly ball, even though he is mostly a two-pitch guy. So I think Cease is going around, I want to say, pick 70 to 80 right now. So you're definitely getting him lower than last year. But, you know, I think the market at this point with all the metrics we have is sharp enough to know that, you know, Cease hasn't taken a huge step back necessarily.
One extremely weird thing about Dylan Cease is that his BABIP switches between mid-300s and mid-200s every season. So this past season was a mid-300s BABIP year, which, hey, maybe this new year in Toronto is going to be a mid-200s BABIP pitcher, which, hey, maybe that makes him actually more valuable drafting. But I don't know. I think one of the weird things is just the fact that he's a two-pitch pitcher where, like, the two pitches aren't as elite as they used to be. All right, like, they're still good. They're still above average. That fastball slider combo is really, really solid still. But they just aren't as sharp as they were previously. And so, yeah, I don't know. It just feels like he's still a really solid pitcher, but maybe not that top 10 elite guy anymore that, you know, maybe expected a couple years back. The other weird thing, too, 32 starts from Cease last year, only 168 innings, though. So not really a volume guy, even though he was relatively healthy throughout the entire year. And so it just makes drafting him kind of a weird thing where it's like, do you want to place like a high pick, you know, essentially, what is that, fifth round, like a fifth rounder on a guy who has the high, really high highs. But like we saw last year, the lows are can be pretty tough as well.
Yeah, he was really struggling to get past five innings on a consistent basis. You know, pitch counts going way up. So, yeah, I think I might be a little hesitant at the price. You know, we'll see when I really dive into prep. He did have this is his third straight season with a left on base rate at 69%, even though his career is 73%. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, if he kind of reverts back to his career mean or just kind of continues to struggle at a, you know, stranding guys at a slightly below average rate. I'm thinking like maybe it'd be fun to pair him with like Jacob deGrom or something, right? Like a guy who you think the ratios are going to be really good if he's on the field. He does have some injury risk, but Cease does not have injury risk, at least not anymore than, you know, other starting pitchers. So I think maybe that would be a fun kind of build if you do want to go like two pitchers in your first five or six picks. But it's still, yeah, it's a little scary to, you know, click the name of a guy who was objectively bad last year, but I think you do have to trust the skills to some extent.
Yeah, and if there's another concern too, and I mean, I don't know how big of a concern this is. San Diego, one of the better pitcher parks in the league for sure. And Toronto is just like about average. 100 park factor for them on StatCast, 97 for the Padres. So it's not like it's a crazy difference. The AL East in general, kind of generally the parks are a little bit more, you know, pitcher or sorry, more hitter friendly. than the NL West, but not like so much so that, you know, it should affect his results too much. But just a small note that he is going to be pitching more likely in an environment that is a little bit better for hitters than he was the past 2 years.
Yeah, and you hope that the Blue Jays defense can kind of counteract that, and you feel confident. I think they'll be an above average defense, but it's really hard to predict, you know, if they're going to be a leader, if they're just going to be like, you know, top 12 or something like that.
Right, and they're shuffling stuff around too, right? They just signed Kazuma Okamoto, which he probably slots in at third base for them, because Vlad's obviously going to be at first. But then, you know, Bo Bichette's still a free agent. Not sure if he's going back to Toronto. And then, you know, that leaves kind of, I think, Jimenez at second. And then so, right now, you know, the infield is a little bit of flux for that team too.
Yeah. Hopefully Varsho can, you know, chase down a lot of fly balls for him. He's really good out there in center. So
yeah,
we'll see. From one newly minted AL East arm to another, this one via trade. I guess he was already AL East, right? He went from one AL East team to the other. The Rays to Orioles, Shane Boz. He had a 4.87 ERA versus a 3.88 xFIP. I think the most obvious one that's kind of been talked about ad nauseum was Steinbrenner Field. Shane Boz was just dreadful there, and he was pretty solid on the road. Obviously, it's a minor league park, and a lot of fly balls that are not homers elsewhere were there. So that definitely hurt him. I don't think anybody's going to argue that he's a high fours ERA talent. He is a career underperformer of xFIP at this point with a 0.32 difference. His xFIP is 0.32 runs lower than his career ERA, but he's only pitched like 325 career innings. So I don't think you can draw too much from that now at this point. What do you think about Boz? Do you think that he is kind of a cherry bomb on the bat in the bad way? You know, like a lot of real ratio risk exists here. Do you think that Steinbrenner Field was just kind of amplifying some of his issues?
I mean, I think if you compare it to his previous seasons, which again, there isn't much sample there, unfortunately, this was literally his first full season. The Trop is just a better park for pitchers compared to Steinbrenner Field. And then if you just compare Orioles Park and Yankee Stadium, because I think Steinbrenner Field is basically supposed to imitate Yankee Stadium, they're about the same. Like Camden is like about as bad for pitchers in terms of hitting homers as Yankee Stadium is. So even though he's technically moving out from Steinbrenner Field, he's like going to a park that where for half of his starts, like it's still not going to be great for him. You know, arguably if he stayed with the Rays, I think I might've been a little bit more optimistic about Boz. The other thing is just like he doesn't really have like a number one like blowaway pitch anymore. That used to be the slider for him back when he was starting out, but that pitch just is not that great for him anymore. He now has a cutter instead of the slider, and it's just it's effective, but it's not as good as that slider used to be. And so yeah, I don't know. It's to me, I'm a little worried about him going to Baltimore just because I don't think it's like an improvement for him in terms of park. But maybe he is able to find something a little bit more, like a little change of scenery will be nice for him. And, you know, if he can at least put together his second full season, that just gives us more information on Shane Boz. But unfortunately, I think the problem is we just don't have enough data on him because he just has not pitched a lot.
Yeah, I do think that his value would have been a little bit higher if he had stayed in Tampa, even if it's a little bit worse of a team context. I do think, like you said, he's kind of adjusting his arsenal, you know, coming off of surgery. That like trademark slider has now turned into like a pretty good hard curveball. You know, it's tough to depend on guys who have a curveball as their number two pitch, but it does sit 85. So it's more of a kind of power curve than like a, you know, a big looper. So yeah, I think there's some ratio risk here as well with Boz, but I do like his chances of kind of returning to maybe like a four ERA guy, which at that price, I think is decent, especially if maybe you can pick and choose your matchups here. You know, he's a guy who will put together some really good high strikeout outings, and maybe you can avoid him, you know, in some tougher spots.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because like in my dynasty league, I have both Shane Boz and Sandy. And so I'm like, both those guys are not anchoring the rotation, but you know, they're big parts of that rotation. I'm just like wondering, like, do I keep these guys after the season that just happened in 2025? Or do I hold on to them and hope something better can happen? And I think for Boz, like, I'm still willing to hold because, again, we only have really one season of data. And even though it wasn't great, you know, I'm kind of hoping that, you know, being in a new park and with a new team is going to help him just a little bit, maybe exercise some of those demons.
Yeah, I think it would be tough to sell low on either one of those guys, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And moving to someone who was a cherry bomb in, I guess, the good side of the cherry bomb, but really did hurt you a couple of times. That's Jesus Luzardo, the lefty on the Phillies. He had a 3.92 ERA versus a 3.25 xFIP. And I think a lot of this can be chalked up to a couple of really bad outings that he had kind of in the middle of the season, maybe like the second third of the season, I would say. He just got bombed a couple of times. There were some concerns about pitch tipping. And like I said, xFIP doesn't, you know, account for situational pitching. So if a guy gives up a ton of runs in one outing, you know, they're going to see some of that as unlucky. So it's, you know, I think that's explaining a lot of the difference here. But at the same time, he is a career xFIP underperformer. 4.19 career ERA versus 3.72 xFIP. So that's almost half a run over 700 innings. I think that's one of the bigger differences that you will see. So that just kind of lend support to the idea that he's going to give up more home runs than you'd expect just based on his fly ball rate, because he does give up some hard contact. And I think maybe some of that's platoon related too. Like he really struggles against right-handed hitters. And he developed a sweeper this year, which is going to help him mow down lefties even better, but it's not going to help him against righties. So yeah, I think he's maybe a little bit volatile still, but super high ceiling here, as we kind of saw the first couple of months of last year.
Yeah, it's funny to put him in this underperforming list, because I think he's the one guy out of this group that, like, was it like a top 40 pitcher consistently throughout the season. Mm-hmm. And Luzardo, he just had a dramatic improvement in his homers, and like compared to his seasons with the Marlins. That being said, again, like the Phillies park is still like not great for homers, so that probably explains some of the issues there. One Statcast number I was like looking at, which I don't really completely understand, was that his net bases prevented was -6, which is not a good number, but like basically like kind of deals with stolen bases and catching and stuff like that. Which is interesting because, you know, paired with JT Realmuto, you kind of expect that, like, hey, the he'd be able to catch a couple more guys caught stealing. But I guess for Luzardo, you know, there was just a couple more runs that were let in, or, you know, a couple extra bases, let's say, that may have led to more runs because of, you know, guys getting a steal while he was pitching. So just some interesting things. Overall, the difference between ERA and xFIP isn't dramatic. I think he's still a cherry bomb. I think when you draft him, that's what you're going to expect. And just kind of hope that he has like 20, basically you're kind of hoping he has like 20 really good starts, 5 average ones and 5 really horrible ones. And you just deal with the fact that, yeah, you're going to have those 5 bad ones from time to time.
Yeah, this one's interesting because he was an underperformer, but he also had a 9% homer per fly ball rate, which averages like 12 to 13, and that's his career low. So, you know, he was actually lucky in some respects compared to, you know, what you would consider a typical underperformer. So I think like the run clustering with the really bad outings is a big factor for that. But I do think, yeah, he's a guy who is going to get hit hard sometimes. I'm looking at him like right next to Dylan Cease, basically in ADP. They're both at 70. I think I'm leaning Cease because he does have a little bit longer of a track record. But at the same time, it might be neither, honestly, depending on your, you know, risk tolerance at that price.
Yeah, and it kind of depends on what you've drafted already, right? If you're looking at fifth, sixth round, this is maybe where you're picking up your second pitcher, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so do you want to have either of these really volatile guys as like your number two guy, or do you want someone who's just maybe a little bit more established, a little bit more safe in that spot? So I know in our mock draft earlier this year, we had Luzardo, but that's because we had already a pretty solid base prior to picking him up. So we felt good about going with a little bit more risk there. But, you know, at this price, that might be a little too high for some folks.
Yeah, especially in a shallower format, I feel better about the risk. You know, 15 teamer, a little scary as the SP2, but, you know, 15 teamer, you're going to have some holes in your team. So lastly, on the underperformer side, as Will Warren from the Yankees, he had a 4.44 ERA, 3.91 xFIP. So a little bit smaller, you know, he's all the way at the bottom of the top 10 with just a half run difference here, basically. He was the guy who I really loved as a buy low. I was trying to trade for him in some leagues unsuccessfully just because he was underperforming by so much. But he kind of faded down the stretch a little bit. I was looking at his game logs earlier today. He allowed at least one home run in each of his last seven outings and only went six innings once in his last eight starts. So he's a guy who, yeah, he scuffled a little bit down the stretch, and that kind of saw his estimators push up towards his ERA instead of his ERA falling down towards his estimators. And yeah, he's a guy who, like Luzardo, obviously he's from the right side, while Luzardo's from the left, but he really struggles with opposite-handed hitters too. A lot of that, I think, is because his arsenal is built around sinker and sweeper. His strikeout-to-walk rate, strikeout-minus-walk rate, was 15 percentage points higher against righties than lefties. So yeah, I'm a little bit concerned just, you know, if Warren faces a lot of lineups that are stacked with lefties, like some of the AL East lineups are, you know, he could really get hurt. So I don't think I'm going to be targeting him at his current price. He's looking like it's cheap though, right? So his ADP 330, right? So if you want to take a late dart, maybe he's a good option, but I definitely have a little bit of concern.
Yeah, and there's always just the whole like lefties at Yankee Stadium do pretty well. So don't love that. But yeah, pretty much the reason why there's this difference is just because he gave a bunch of homers. But yeah, ultimately, I think I'm with you. You know, he's probably a good, like, really late round pick if you're kind of looking for some guy with some upside. But yeah, the homer issue is just really tough. And unless he changes that approach, it's going to be tough to, like, really trust him in a lot of spots.
Yeah, I guess I'm looking at the arms that are going around him. This is like from Draft Champions drafts the last few weeks. Like, I guess I would probably prefer him to like Brian Bello and Cade Cavalli, who are going right below him. You know, those guys. I know Bello was decent last year, but I don't necessarily believe in it. And then going above him, you have like Jonah Tong, who I don't know if he's going to return a ton of value this year. And then Brady Singer is like 10 picks above him, who I know has hurt us in the past, and it's kind of a similar pitcher, honestly, to Will Warren. Maybe I'd prefer Brady Singer, but yeah, I guess that price does feel kind of right, so I guess I'm not crossing him off my board.
Yeah, there's just a lot of things that like you'd like him to clean up, and you know, granted, last year was really his first, you know, full year in the majors, so you know, maybe another offseason of development with the, you know, with the big league team, maybe that helps bring down the whip just a touch. Makes him a little bit more palatable to roster. And I mean, the fact is he still managed to get 9 wins, even though the rest of the stats weren't incredible. So, you know, when you pitch for the Yankees, for the most part, you still aren't going to have get a little bit bump in that compared to the other guys around you. So if that's something you're looking for in the late rounds, right? The kind of just the names you mentioned with Bello and Cavalli, you know, Warren's going to have at least probably a better chance of getting more wins than either of those guys. And so that could be a reason for wanting to draft him over, you know, some of the other players in that range.
Yeah, and I guess there's some concern about role. He's the SP4 right now ahead of Yarbrough, but then you have Cole and Rodon on the IL who are probably going to miss the first couple months at least. So, you know, you could be scared about what's going to happen to him in June, but I feel like a lot of times those things work themselves out. So I wouldn't worry about that too much. You know, obviously it's something to know when you're picking him, but I don't think it would ding him too much in my mind.
Right. Like, for example, Luis Gil is ahead of him right now as the SP3. He could be in AAA, you know, come in like 2 months into the season. So, yeah, a lot could certainly happen that, you know, might be able to secure his position in that rotation.
Yeah, exactly. So now we're going to move from the unlucky to the guys who seemed, you know, like Lady Luck was on their side last year. And this is the top 10 in the fantasy relevant overperforming pitchers, overperforming quote unquote, because obviously it's more complicated than that. I think the innings minimum I set here was like 130. So it's guys who did, you know, take a decent workload. On the high end here, it's 1.44 runs of difference. The low end is 0.96. So the big overperformers actually had a lot higher magnitude than the big underperformers, which is interesting. We start off with someone who I'm sure everybody who follows, you know, fantasy knows will be on this list. That's Andrew Abbott, Nathan Eovaldi, Freddie Peralta, Noah Cameron, Paul Skeens, Brian Bello, Gavin Williams, Matthew Boyd, Nick Pivetta, and Drew Rasmussen. So we're going to talk about six of these guys. We are going to start off with Andrew Abbott. I feel like he is basically the epitome of the he can't keep getting away with this meme. He does this every single year, even though he pitches in a bad home park. 2.87 ERA versus 4.31 xFIP. And yeah, this is starting to get to the point where I'm wondering if this is a skill. He's pitched 400 innings in his career. He has an ERA of 3.42. And then all of his metrics are way higher. Expected ERA, 3.82, 4.26 FIP, 4.42 CR, and 4.58 XFIP. So depending on which of those you look at, he's either getting a little bit lucky or really, really lucky. So the market, you know, is kind of aware of this. You know, they're tentative. He's just outside pick 200. So do you like Abbott there as kind of like a ratio guy? Do you, obviously last year is probably a high watermark, but do you think that he can be a good, you know, dependable ERA option?
When I was kind of prepping for this, the one stat I just decided to look at and base all my analysis off was, what's your batting average against when you have men on base? Mm-hmm. And Abbott, pretty solid. Not at the top of that list, actually, surprisingly. But still pretty decent with him. He was top 25 among pitchers with over 2,000 pitches. But, you know, he brought down his walk rate. He struck out a couple more hitters this season. Was just in general able to keep runners off the base paths. So that kind of helped with him, even though he, you know, pitches for the Reds. And it wasn't dramatic improvement, which I think is actually encouraging. Like, it wasn't that he, like, found something and, like, improved something by, like, 5%. It's like he got a little bit better in different areas, and it still worked. So, it feels like the other shoe is going to drop with him because, you know, it just feels like what you said, he can't keep getting away with this. But the numbers seem to back up that he's apparently has this skill in terms of, like, not letting a lot of guys on base. And then when guys get on base, he does a really good job of not making it worse for himself. I think the challenge with Abbott is that the ERA is really solid. Everything else is just kind of like, yeah, it's all right. So that probably still limits his, you know, upward velocity up draft rankings. But nonetheless, I think you can probably say this is somewhat believable.
Yeah. I think I do have confidence in a mid to high threes ERA. I don't know if 3.42 his career mark, you know, seems a little bit too low for me. But like you said, it's ERA is providing value, but probably not a lot else, right? He strikes out less than a batter per inning. He's not really a whip guy. His career whip is not great despite, you know, a great career ERA. The wins on Cincinnati are probably going to be mediocre. He does have a left on base rate skill, I would say, at this point. His 81% left on base rate for his career is second best minimum 300 innings pitch since he debuted in 2023. The only one who's better is Paul Skeens. So I think that he's going to regress a little bit in that area, but I do think it's something where he does tailor his approach a lot when there's runners on base. He also he allows one home run per nine with runners on base versus 1.5 with nobody on. So he's clearly more willing to kind of attack guys with nobody on base. So I do think that he's tailoring his approach a little bit here, which will allow him to beat his estimators. But I think, you know, it's not reasonable to expect him to beat it more than maybe like half a run versus, you know, almost a run and a half this past year.
Right. There's just nothing particularly nasty with him, but he's probably a guy who, you know, you feel good about in like the last solid starting spot in your rotation, right? Like, you probably aren't going to be Abbott, probably, to me, is someone who's a little bit better than someone who's just on the waiver wire constantly, and only gets picked up for good matchups and bad matchups. You know, he still is able to offer you at least a pretty decent floor. I just don't think there's really any ceiling with him, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it would be nice to say, like, you always start him on the road and then you start him in easier home matchups, but he's been almost a run better at home for his career than on the road. So, you know, I guess the small park, you know, if he generates a lot of weak contact in the air, everything's getting caught, right? Because the outfielders don't have to worry about stuff behind him. So maybe he's found a way to, you know, make it work in his favor.
Yeah, I mean, actually, this is kind of funny. 14% pop-up rate. Last season, 91st percentile.
Yeah, that's really good.
So, and that's despite a 89th percentile fly ball rate. But literally all those fly balls, I guess, are just, it looks like they're pop-ups. So he's doing a really good job and somehow just limiting that weak contact in the air.
Yeah, we'll see if he can keep it up. So someone who also was really lucky last year, but has a completely different approach than Abbott, is Freddy Peralta. The Brewers, maybe traded, but Brewers for now. 2.7 ERA versus a 3.85 XFIP. He is a career XFIP beater, so his career ERA is 3.59 with the XFIP at 3.79. So small career gap, not this huge one that we saw last year. One thing with Peralta, I think he'll always be a low BABIP guy. He's really hard to hit. He has great extension, right? He has a good fastball, and his control, he's also a little all over the place, right? So maybe a little bit effectively wild, and also not afraid to walk a guy instead of give up a hit. So he always kind of has that low BABIP, and I think that allows him to have a good whip despite the poor walk rate. But the left on base, again, we're going to talk about that quite a bit here, but his was the highest last year among all qualified pitchers by a full percentage point. I think Garrett Crochet was second. Good pitchers leave more guys on base, right, because they get more outs. But at the same time, 85.5%, that's got to fall. So I think that the low ERA with Peralta here is a mirage, but I think that the rest of it, is really promising. So I like him, but it might not necessarily be in on that price, which it looks like he's going close to Dylan Cease, right? He's going pick 63, so a little bit ahead of that Cease and Luzardo combo we talked about earlier.
Peralta also kind of focused on giving up contact in the air as well, 38% ground ball rate, which is 21st percentile. So he tries to basically generate a few more fly balls, which helps for him because he pitches, half his games at least in Miller Park, whatever it's called now, which is not a great park for hitters. So, that helps in his context as well, assuming he stays on the Brewers this upcoming season. Again, looking at the, batting average allowed against when runners on base, he's the second best in the majors at 179. So he really effectively shuts down. He really shuts down players when there's someone on base. So that helps keep the run total down. Last year also a pretty decent year for him in terms of reducing homers. 21% home run per fly ball rate in 2024. 2025, that was 18%, so a 3% improvement there. Actually kind of gets down to his career average is at 24%, but I'm not sure if that number actually makes sense with just the rest of his career numbers. But regardless, he was able to suppress homers at a pretty decent rate last year. So kind of believing that happening this year, maybe that's maybe something we can't expect. Maybe something a little bit more of a regression to his career mean might be expected. And so that might mean that ERA is going to go up a little bit more this upcoming year. So yeah, I'd probably expect like a mid threes from him. Not this high twos one. That's probably not going to happen again. But it is going to, bump up his draft stock, which, I think like you, I'm maybe a little cautious there if I expect it to get a little bit worse this season.
Yeah, I think, the 3.91 ERA that Steamer has him for is pretty pessimistic. I think the 3.67 at the bat, which just came out, makes a lot more sense to me. And just a note on home run per fly ball rate, pitcher list, our player pages, we have a different definition of fly ball. So the home run per fly ball rates are going to be higher on our player pages versus like Fangraphs. I've mostly been quoting Fangraphs just because I know the league average on Fangraphs better is around 13%. There might be some differences there depending on, what player page you're referring to.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
So another lefty, right? It seems like there's quite a few crafty lefties here on the overperformers list, which, maybe lends some analytical support to that, that crafty lefty idea that we've always heard about. Noah Cameron for the Royals. He was also sub 3, 2.99 ERA versus a 4.10 xFIP. And he's kind of fits into that swatch archetype that had a lot of success last year. The Knicks, branded the southpaw with a tight changeup, right? Cameron has a deep arsenal, but the changeup has always been his best graded pitch in prospect reports. And that's going to help him, get righties out while he attacks lefties with his breaking stuff. So I don't think you need to worry a ton about platoon splits or anything like that with Cameron, which is nice. But the 84% left on base rate and the 241 BABIP, do seem to be doing some heavy lifting here. So I think he's being considered kind of a ratios play. But, the price does, it's not like everyone's buying it, right? He's a 255 ADP. So, maybe he's a late target that you go for to, hope he spikes another solid ratio season, even if the estimators don't fully back it up.
I really like him at that price, if not a little bit more than that. And granted, that's based off one season, but he did have 24 starts, as a rookie. So we did get to see a lot of that out of him. Strikeout numbers are, lower than they were in the minors, but that's somewhat to be expected. But he had, you know, really good run suppression in the minors as well. So there's that. That being said, when this name came up on the board, I was like, I don't know how he did this well. You know, I was just like, he's a rookie. He did really well because, yeah, he just left a lot of guys on base. His batting average against with runners on base, sixth in the league among pitchers with over 2,000 pitches. So, you know, elite in that category. If you want to essentially buy on terms of that ceiling in terms of ratios, I think that's probably worth a pick for me. You know, the other stats around him, probably not that great. I mean, he's going to get some wins and some quality starts from, you know, being on a decent team like the Royals. But again, that strikeout rate isn't good. It was 20% last year. So he's not going to get you a lot of that. So effectively you're kind of getting him for the ratios. And so if you can get that in, you know, the late rounds there and really have a solid guy there, I think that's really worth a gamble there.
Yeah, he pretty much seems like, you know, the exact league average starter, right? Like 20% strikeout rate, 7.5% walk rate, low fours ERA estimators, you know, just over a home run per nine. Like very much kind of a stock average pitcher, which, you know, can have value in fantasy. He's going in the ADP I'm looking at right below Roki Sasaki, which is just like, you want to think about the two most opposite pitchers that might be these two guys. I think I prefer Cameron, but that's just more because like I need to see Sasaki like actually have success as a starter before I buy in on him, at least, you know, more than like one kind of flyer share.
Right. Yeah. Want to see how he does in like a 6-inning game as opposed to a 1-inning relief appearance in the World Series.
Right. I mean, he still only has two pitches and yeah, I gotta see it a little more first. Mm-hmm. So Gavin Williams is the next guy. Another AL Central guy, but he honestly is probably much more similar to Sasaki than Noah Cameron. He has a, you know, stuff over command approach for sure. 3.06 ERA versus 4.08 xFIP. He had a really good ERA, but a poor whip, so it's kind of an interesting year for Williams. 254 BABIP, 84% left on base. You know, those are both well, you know, below average in terms of pretty fortunate. But he's thrown 325 innings in his career, and he's overperforming his expected metrics, his estimators, all of them by at least a half run. So ERA is at 3.54, and the estimators range from 4.14 to 4.38. So he's another guy who I think maybe has some similarities to Peralta in terms of he's hard to hit. He has a big fastball. He's a little bit effectively wild, probably a little bit too wild, you know, at the walk rate pushing above 10%. I don't think I'm going to really be buying on Gavin Williams. He's like pick 160 right now. And again, it kind of seems like an ERA first profile and maybe an ERA only profile at pick 150. But I guess if he fills up the zone a little bit more, you know, he could really take off.
Yeah. Again, a guy who does really well with his approach when there's runners on base. He's sixth among all pitchers with over 2,000 pitches in terms of batting average against. I think the problem I have with Gavin is just there seems to be some ceiling, I guess, in his strikeout rate. But I think in the past three seasons, you know, we've kind of seen him be like just a mid-20s or just a low to mid-20s strikeout rate guy. And then you couple that with the high walk rate, and that's just a little scary for me. Mm-hmm. Just not the combination you want. He still managed 12 wins last year, 14 quality starts. So there's clearly something there where he's able to stay in games and, you know, not give up a ton of runs and be able to maintain that, you know, basically like low threes ERA that I think he could be shooting for this year. But just everything else around him is like not that great. And so it sounds like you're talking about a guy who's a lot like Noah Cameron. Maybe he's got a little bit more strikeout potential in his arsenal, but 100 picks more, you know, based on kind of what you're talking about with ADP. Like, not saying they're similar pitches. I think Gavin probably has got a little bit higher ceiling because he has that potential like strikeout ability. But yeah, that might be a little rich for my blood, if you kind of consider even like the other guys that are going around him at that spot.
Yeah, and I'm just not, you know, barring him just gaining a lot of strike throwing ability, I'm just not seeing a path to him ever having a good or even average walk rate. He doesn't really have a pitch that he gets a ton of chases on. And if you struggle to fill up the zone, you know, and you get below average chases, like you're just going to be walking too many guys to have a palatable whip. So I'm a pretty whip conscious drafter. I think it is a little bit of like a market inefficiency. I think people don't pay enough attention to it. So this is a guy that I'm pretty unlikely to end up with, you know, unless the price is really, you know, he goes pretty far past his ADP.
Yeah. If you want to find any silver lining, his home run rate actually is like not great. His home run per nine was 1.23. On pitcherless, his home run per five ball rate is 20%. And so the fact that he's actually beating an XFIP estimator despite giving up a bunch of homers is kind of impressive, right? He's kind of maybe he's only giving up solo home runs or something like that, right? Like there's possibly like some improvement we could see in that ERA if even that home run rate goes down just a little bit. So something just to consider, right? Like if you just look at the stats and how these estimators are calculated, it is actually kind of interesting that his XFIP is that high because of how many homers he gave up last year.
Yeah, and I guess on the home run thing, I was actually just looking at his game logs on our player pages, and he introduced a sinker to his arsenal that he hadn't thrown it before really in the majors. He only threw it 6% of the time, but he didn't start throwing it until the end of May and didn't feature it like double digit uses until July. And it actually graded out pretty well and had decent results. PLV was above average and the results were okay. So yeah, that might help him, you know, keep the ball on the ground and get hitters off of his fastball, you know, a little bit more.
Yeah. And I guess one other thing, like, again, if you've been following Nick and his SP roundups all last year, he was begging for Gavin to basically use that cutter more as the bridge pitch between his four seam and his sweeper. He did use the cutter 14% of the time last year. It wasn't that good of a pitch, but, you know, if it's meant to be a bridge pitch to a sweeper that's got a nearly 20% strikeout, swing and strike rate, right, like that can lead to good things. I think the problem was just that his fastballs just wasn't that great, all things considered. So if that fastball somehow is able to improve just a little bit, I don't know really what is there. Maybe, I mean, his IVB is not great, 14 inches on that. So somehow there's like some improvement in that fastball that can make his arsenal just a little bit better, you know. You know, we could see a little bit of a breakout there.
Yeah, I think the improvement's just going to be throw it less like he did last year. You can get a lot done with that, you know, fastball, cutter, sinker kind of trio. It's really, really good tunneling, really hard for hitters to square up, especially if you're throwing a couple of decent breaking balls off of it. So I guess I'm maybe talking myself into a little bit more, but we'll see. We'll see, you know, when drafts come around. As we continue to alternate righty-lefty here, we're on to another kind of league winner type guy last year. That's Matthew Boyd staying with the Cubs, which I think is really good for his fantasy value, as we'll talk about. He did 3.21 ERA versus a 4.22 XFIP. Finally put together a healthy season for the first time in years. Another swatch similar to the Cameron mold. Changeup was easily his best pitch, and he really, really went after righties with it. It's not like a pitch that, like, when you watch on video, looks amazing. It kind of floats in there, but he spots it fantastically, and that was really the key. There was nothing that was particularly alarming when you look at, like, the luck trio of home run per fly ball rate and BABIP and left on base rate, but his home run per fly ball rate was pretty low, 8.4%, fourth lowest among qualified starters. But, you know, Wrigley Field will kind of help you out with that, as well as a good Cubs defense in terms of the BABIP. So, yeah, I think that Matthew Boyd, you know, this is a career year, but, you know, the market's not really buying into him fully. So I think I could end up with him. He's like pick 226 right now, it looks like. So a little bit ahead of Cameron. So if you see them as similar, you probably prefer Cameron. But, yeah, I've got some interest in Boyd, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not great in terms of the strikeout rate, but it doesn't seem very luck motivated because of that left on base rate being pretty low, as you mentioned, or not pretty low. I mean, it is a little bit above average, but it's not like the elite numbers
that we've seen
from the other guys. He's actually not even that great when you look at his batting average with runners on base. He's got a 283 there. So it seems real is what I'll say. 17 quality starts, I think, is not something you should overlook from him. The fact that he was able to stay in games as long as he did and still be able to maintain, you know, pretty decent run numbers is solid. Walk rate was, you know, low as well at 5.8%. So if that kind of continues and he has a low whip, kind of what you were going about a little bit earlier about, like, you know, it's kind of good to draft guys on whip and you know, that is kind of a skill to be able to prevent those walks and those hits, right? If that's what we expect to see out of Matthew Boyd, and he does deliver on that, I do think he's absolutely worth it at that pick value.
Yeah, and I think Boyd is a guy who in spring training, I don't, read a ton into spring, but I'm gonna want to make sure that he's throwing, close, basically as hard as he was last year. He had like a little bit of a velo spike. He was sitting 93 versus, 91, 92 the last couple of years. And I think that made a big difference for him. And he did fade down the stretch a little bit too. I think he struggled in the playoffs, and most of his great starts were kind of in the middle of the season. So or early and in the middle. So I'm going to want to make sure that he looks sharp and, looks pretty fresh because he is coming off of, the highest workload he's had in quite a while. So I'm not like, just no thought drafting him, but I do think that he's a guy who in Wrigley Field with a good defense and on a decent team, can continue to provide some value.
Hey, he's turning 35 this year, right? So that's enough of a reason to be like cautious, I think. But at the same time, right, he's not a guy that relies on very high velocity, right? He seems to be more of a guy that, tries to place pitches in the right places. That's why his called strike rates are, pretty solid. Don't know how they compare to the rest of the league, but he's got a really good, he just locates his pitches pretty well. I'll just say that. But yeah, it's not going to be, a guy who's in like the mid-20s of a strikeout rate, right? You just kind of expect that that's just not going to happen with him. And if you're okay with that, then yeah, he could be definitely worth it in, rounds 15 through 20.
Yeah, and one thing on the changeup that I had mentioned before is it's just a velo differential. His velo went up on the fastball a tick, tick and a half, and his velo on the changeup went down 2 ticks. So there's a 15 mile per hour difference there. So that's something that can be really effective if you sell it with your arm action. So I think that's definitely contributing to the success of the offering too. Getting a lot of righties out in front, a lot of weak contact, and if as long as he still has a feel, I think that he could sustain that to some extent.
I guess I'll take that back. His called strike rate actually wasn't that good, 60% last season. But again, he's not wasting pitches, right? He's not
No.
walking a lot of guys. And so his BABIP is a 276, which is, fine. It's a little bit above average. So for him, like, even though he's not getting a bunch of strikeouts and stuff like that, he is using his pitches in an effective way to be able to prevent runs.
And to wrap us up here, we have Nick Pivetta of the Padres. Seemingly, he's going to stay in San Diego, but I think there has been a little bit of trade rumors, which would probably hurt his fantasy value because San Diego is a good place to pitch. He was a 2.87 ERA versus 3.85 xFIP. Last year, first time Pivetta has ever had an ERA below 4, and he went below 3, so good for him. Definitely getting out of Fenway, I think, was really helping him out here. And also a 235 BABIP was too. Pivetta is kind of an interesting one because, I like to look at the career track record, but he's also kind of reinvented himself as a pitcher. He really struggled in Philly and, had some decent seasons in Boston and before kind of breaking out last year. He's a huge underperformer in terms of ERA versus xFIP for his career. But like I said, he's a different guy now. He's added a sweeper. He's kind of got that pure over the top arm angle. So I don't want to buy into the underperforming narrative too much, but at the same time, that probably means we shouldn't buy into the overperforming narrative too much either, right?
Yeah, I mean, some of the numbers around him, eighth best in terms of batting average with runners on base. Left on base rate is back to that a little bit elite-ish number, 81st percentile there. Home run suppression, again, as you expected, going to the Padres helps that out a lot. So, that explains a lot of these numbers and why they improved for him from last year to, or from 2024 to 2025.
Yeah, he's a guy where I didn't get him in any leagues last year, even though I wanted to, and I was kind of kicking myself. I think he was like pick 170, which ended up being awesome value. But at the same time, I'm not gonna, get frustrated and just get him this year because I didn't get him last year. The price is pick 87 right now. It's like pitchers going around, like Framber Valdez is going right after him. I know he hasn't signed yet, but I think I would probably take him every day of the week over Nick Pivetta. And that's not because I hate Nick Pivetta. I just think that Framber Valdez is a little bit, just a better option there.
Yeah, and even if he does regress, I mean, jokingly, like he gets back to a 4 ERA, his WHIP is still like not terrible, right? The last 2 seasons in Boston, 1.12, 1.13. Granted, it's a little bit worse than that in the years prior to that, but he also just wasn't that good of a pitcher in those prior years. And so, yeah, even though his WHIP was below 1 this season, maybe it only goes up like up to 1.15 or something like that, right? That's still pretty reasonable. If his strikeout rate stays above 25%, right, that makes him a little bit viable too. I think it just, like, he feels like a guy with a, I mean, I hesitate to say a decent floor because we don't know where he's going to be, and having a floor of a 4 ERA is not really a good thing. But he does seem like a guy who's, like, you know, really a really solid guy to anchor your rotation, like a really, you know, a good SP 2 or SP 3 where you generally don't have to worry about him too much. You know, 19 quality starts last season, right? That's pretty solid. But it was his career high by a pretty fair amount. So I think this, it feels weird to feel like you're taking a risk on a floor guy. But that might be how you want to think about it, right? Like, do you feel like, I think if we get more news that Pivetta is staying in San Diego, I feel like you could be a little bit more, you could feel a little bit better about drafting him this high.
Yeah, I mean, posting a 1.12 and 1.13 whip in like 300 innings in Fenway Park before he came to the Padres, that's impressive. I mean, that's not something that you see even from really solid starting pitchers. You got guys like Brian Bello who, you know, like push 1.3 even with a decent ERA. So, yeah, I think that he could get to value maybe in the same way that someone like Bailey Ober has gotten to value before, you know, it all kind of fell apart last year. But I think, yeah, maybe the Ober experience does tell us that it's a little bit tenuous there because, you know, the ERA could swell. But yeah, I'm not out on Pivetta, but I think I would feel more comfortable with like a, you know, 100 ADP rather than, you know, 85 to 90.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense too. I mean, he did finish his last ranking on the list, I guess, was 24th. So if you just like think about the top 25 pitchers coming off the board, you know, grabbing someone like Pivetta, 87 ADP, you know, that's putting you in round, what, 7, 8, 9-ish, essentially?
Yeah, 7, 8 of a 12-teamer.
Yeah. I don't know if the top 25 pitchers are all gone by that point.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. It looks like there's 3, 4, 5, 6, 8 closers in there. Actually, no, 10 closers in there. So that would be Pivetta's pitcher 37 on my ADP data, so that would put him at SP 27. So okay, kind of right outside looking in. Yeah, I guess we'll see, you know, where Nick's got him on the list. I wouldn't imagine he's, you know, too far outside of the top 30 if he is even outside of it at all.
Right, because you want to assume that he's going to stay in San Diego and have mm-hmm. as good of a season, right? Like, to he's not going to probably have like an ERA below 3, but if he's got, you know, like a low to mid 3s ERA and a, you know, 1.1 whip, like that plays really, really well with, you know, a 27% strikeout rate, if we assume that happens. So, yeah, if you want to be optimistic, I don't see necessarily a problem with that price. But yeah, I feel the same where it's like, yeah, an ADP of 100 would be really nice to get Pivetta at if that would be possible.
Yeah. I mean, he's obviously this will change and, you know, every format's different, but he's one of only 4 SPs going between pick 85 and pick 110. So I guess a lot of people are going hitters there. So maybe he'll fall down the board a little bit and you can get him, you know, closer to that price that feels a little bit more comfortable.
Right. And I mean, that's a big thing about drafts, right? Like, you got to figure out where the runs are and, I mean, who's maybe the last guy who doesn't get involved in that run. And then now you can wait a little bit and pick him up a little bit later. So, that's where like maybe stats like min pick and max pick are pretty helpful as well to understand those types of where those players are really actually landing in the draft.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, that is going to wrap it up for this week's episode. Hopefully that was a helpful conversation in just talking about pitchers and ERA estimators and yeah, just how we want to look at these guys going into draft season, which is picking up again. Like the drafts are already happening, right? We already have ADP data, but you know, NFBC, I know, like, I think they just announced this week that like half of the main events already filled up. So, you know, drafting is going in full swing and in those areas, and I'm sure in your home leagues, right, you're already maybe thinking about when do you want to schedule that draft. And, you know, even though we're what, a little less than 4 months away from opening day, right? A lot of thinking to do with how you want to structure your fantasy teams this year. So, definitely some very good conversation. But yeah, we will be back in a couple weeks. Obviously, PitchCon's coming up, so that might mess up with our scheduling. But of course, you can, again, follow us on Twitter, ThisWeekPL. You can send us your comments and questions at thisweekplpod@gmail.com. You can find myself on Twitter at TheJohnK. You can find Patrick at PFitzgerald_99. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to the Pitchless podcast feed on Apple, Spotify, YouTube. Wherever you listen, make sure you leave us a 5-star review if you enjoy the show. Lastly, sign up for Pitchless Pro. By doing so, you can join us on the Pitchless Discord right around the time when draft talk is picking up. So definitely a good time to join the Discord and get advice from all the fantasy experts and writers over there. That is all for this week. We'll be back soon with another episode of This Week in Fantasy Baseball. For Patrick, I'm John, and we'll see you in the next one. Later, everyone.